This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 1205. Welcome to the Thursday edition of the WBBM Noon Business Hour, presented by the Village of Bedford Park, also sponsored by GWC Law. I'm Jim Gutis.
And I'm Chris Kreidel. We have mostly sunny skies, a high of 71. It's a great evening for baseball. We'll have the five-day forecast coming up.
Let's see what's happening on the markets as we go live to Bloomberg and Joan Doniger.
Not such a great day on Wall Street, Jim. But while Wall Street is backing away from its records, it's not backing away from the Dow's newest milestone. The Dow is down 28 points, but it's trading at 23,129. The NASDAQ is down 38, the S&P falling 3. Tech stocks are leading the way lower. Apple is hitting all three averages, with shares down about 3% on a report of a cut in iPhone 8 orders for the rest of the year because of lagging sales, as well as word that China has pulled the plug on connectivity for the new Apple Watch, for which you don't need a cell phone. Some strategists even note that today's anniversary is providing some of the pressure on Wall Street, the anniversary of the 1987 stock market crash. And with the steep run-up in stocks since last year's election, they say that could be making investors cautious. The Bloomberg WBBM Chicago Index also falling. It's down 2/3%. On some drag from United Airlines, its shares have fallen 11%. The airline reporting the summer fare war has hit it hard as it cut ticket prices to keep up. Back to you, Jim and Chris.
Thanks, Joan. On today's Noon Business Hour, as Joan mentioned, we're going to be looking back 30 years ago to that huge one-day crash on Wall Street. Could it happen again? What kind of rules have been imposed since then? And we're also talking about the Cubs. You know, tickets cost a little more today than they did yesterday.
I wonder why that is. By the way, on Technology Thursday, sponsored by Baird, we'll be taking a look at when's the right time to get a kid a smartphone. Some advice that you might want to listen to, especially if you've got a youngster who wants a smartphone. And we'll also
they all do.
Yeah, of course. And we'll also check the ups, or maybe we should say downs, of Apple today. That's all ahead on the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
If you were in the stock market 30 years ago today, you probably still remember the free fall. Percentage-wise, it was the worst single-session loss in the history of Wall Street. We're talking with Vahan Janjigian, the Chief Investment Officer at Greenwich Wealth Management in Greenwich, Connecticut, author of the book, Even Buffett Isn't Perfect. Welcome back to the program, Vahan. I guess the most interesting question is, could it happen again?
You know, I think that's very unlikely. Even that particular event in 1987 was such an outlier. So I guess the answer is anything could happen, but I think something like this is very unlikely. There are a lot more safeguards in the market today than there were back then, for example. There are circuit breakers that will automatically stop trading. And we haven't seen anything like this. Even during the financial crisis, we didn't see a day when a quarter of the value of the stock market was wiped out.
Remind us, what was it that caused the crash, the collapse?
Well, you know, there were people who had warned that the market was overvalued. There were some things that happened in Europe that made investors nervous, and there was just panic selling. But I think the most important lesson to be learned from that event is that these are events that long-term investors can largely ignore. In fact, in 1987, the Dow was actually up. Slightly more than 2% for the full year. It was up the following year. It was up the year after that. So if you're a long-term investor, you can ignore these things. And I think another important lesson to be learned is that if you're a short-term investor, maybe you shouldn't be in stocks, or maybe you shouldn't have much invested in stocks. You know, another lesson I would say is that you know, dollar cost averaging can be a very effective way to invest, because dollar cost averaging automatically forces you to buy more shares at lower prices and fewer shares at higher prices. And I think, you know, people should learn from events like this that, you know, the worst thing they can do is panic. There were a lot of people who sold that day simply because the market was down, and they didn't get back in the market again until the market had climbed back up and they felt more confident about investing. I mean, these are the kinds of things that people, I think, over the years have learned that they should take advantage of. And so when we see big sell-offs, we have large numbers of investors who come in and buy stocks and keep the market from falling further.
What are some of the safeguards that are in place now to prevent the type of fall that we saw in 87?
Well, I think the most important thing are these circuit breakers that automatically stop trading when the stock market falls a certain amount. So we have safeguards that will stop trading for 30 minutes, and we have safeguards that will stop trading for the full day. It allows investors to come back to their senses and prevents this kind of panic. Now, on the other hand, we do have a lot of computerized trading these days, and we did see during the flash crash, for example, that the computers started automatically selling things without a lot of reason behind that. So we can see exaggerated movements because of that. But again, if you're a rational long-term investor, my advice is when you see these kinds of events happen, look at them as opportunities to buy more shares. The fact of the matter is that over the long term, the stock market goes up despite, all of these gyrations we see day to day. If you're a long-term investor, you can be pretty confident that the market's going to be higher, 10, 15, 20 years from now than it is today.
Vahan, thanks so much for joining us. As always, Vahan Janjigian, Chief Investment Officer at Greenwich Wealth Management in Greenwich, Connecticut, and author of the book, Even Buffett Isn't Perfect. Coming up, more on the crash of 87 and a look at today's economic data.
The best daily deal in Chicago, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
We're going to talk more about the crash of 87 now, and we have new economic data today. And we're talking with Carl Tannenbaum, chief economist at Northern Trust here in Chicago. So, Carl, take us back to what you remember about that fateful day in 87.
Well, Jim, I almost hesitate to admit that I have firsthand knowledge because it does tend to date a person, but the thing I remember was the gasps across the trading floor when the final posting was finally arrived at some 20 or 25 minutes after the formal close of trading. It took that long in order to tally up all of the sell orders. And people were wondering whether, because we had had a bad day the prior Friday, whether that would continue on and destroy a lot of value. In retrospect, it's remarkable that the current level of the Dow Jones Industrial Index is 10 times, more than 10 times what it was back then. 10-year interest rates, which were about 10% then, are just a little bit over 2% now. And, of course, the economy back then was just beginning to get its footing on what has been an almost unprecedented generation of prosperity interrupted really only briefly by economic recessions. And while the financial crisis obviously is the biggest example of that, we've shown a resilience in both a market and an economic sense that was not readily apparent that fateful afternoon.
So, Carl, let's compare 1987 to 2017 and what's different today in terms of the markets and whether we should have optimism or should there is any room for pessimism?
Oh, I think we should always be vigilant. If there's a lesson learned from that crash or other corrections is that we shouldn't assume that they'll never happen again. One of the most fateful lines in markets, Jim, as you probably know, is this time is different, which was also the title of an economics book a few years back. And certainly now, as we've had a very long and positive run in the Dow, we should not dismiss the possibility that someday we'll have that kind of correction. That said, among the first things that was done after the crisis was to set into place some circuit breakers, which prevented the overwhelming flood of sell orders from pushing this further than realistic value would go. Other circuit breakers in the market have been implemented since then. The players in the market are a lot different now than they used to be. There are many more retail investors, frankly, today, in both directly and in the form of retirement funds. It may provide a little bit more perspective that keeps markets from getting too far out of control. And central banking, I think, is very different in the way that they approach their policy and interest rates and also a factor of the markets into their deliberations. So those who are watchful about financial stability are certainly much more vigilant than they were back in 1987.
We certainly have a different technology than we did 30 years ago. Is there something in the technology we use today that could cause a crash?
Chris, that's a great question. There's been a lot said about electronic trading systems and the algorithms that drive them. When things start to turn south, it's often said that the signals sent to the computers will begin to accelerate the selling momentum without much human intervention. That poison perspective used to be the order of the day in 1987, the grizzled floor veterans who knew a buying opportunity when they saw one. I still tend to think, though, that when there are those opportunities, that there will be intervention amongst the computer routines that will get markets back on their proper footing and maybe back to advancing. It's not a guarantee that the electronics aren't going to, you know, play a huge role in the speed of trading, but I'm not sure that they necessarily make markets inherently unstable.
Carl, what's your confidence level in the economy right now?
We're going along pretty well, Chris. I'd have to say, you know, this morning we got a jobless claims report, which was the lowest since, I believe, 1973, a time when our labor force was about half as large as it is today, to put that into some perspective. So we're continuing to create employment opportunities and the incomes that go with them, and that should create the momentum that sustains this expansion. We're at 8.5 or so years now, a little short. But this could live on to be the longest expansion that we've ever had. Interest rates are still low. Markets are creating wealth. It is usually very positive for economic activity. So while there are certainly no shortage of potential risks, globally we have things going on with North Korea. We've got the craziness in Spain happening here at home. We're trying to work our way through to a new budget, and we'll be considering a candidate for Fed chair before too long. Nonetheless, markets, again, have shown a lot of resilience and are looking at the long term, which seems very bright.
Carl Tannenbaum, the chief economist at Northern Trust here in Chicago. Always a pleasure to have you on the Noon Business Hour. Coming up, serious business for Cub fans scoring a ticket to tonight's playoff game at Wrigley.
WBBM News Time 1226 and Technology Thursday, sponsored by Baird here on the Noon Business Hour. Let's check the markets with Joan Doniger.
Technology's the problem for Wall Street today. Apple hitting all three averages, sending them lower. The Dow down 24, the NASDAQ 36, the S&P 3. The Bloomberg WBBM Chicago Index falling 0.5% right now. Now let's check in with Pete Manhart at Bates Commodities in Normal. Pete?
Slow trade, not much news out there. We did have good exports in both corn and beans this morning. We have corn for December up 1.75 at 3.50 1/4 in a 2.75 cent range. Beans have been in a 6 cent range from down 4 to up 1.5. They're up 3.75 right now, November at 9.88. And wheat's had a 6 cent range. Right now we are up 3.5 in wheat at 4.33 1/2. Slow light trade. And this is Pete Manhart at Bates Commodities in Normal.
With business at 25 and 55, live from the Bloomberg Newsroom, Joan Doniger, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
WBBM News Time, 1230. Welcome back to the Thursday edition of the Noon Business Hour, presented by the Village of Bedford Park and also sponsored by UChicago Medicine. I'm Jim Gutis.
I'm Chris Kreidel, and these are the top stories on News Radio and the Noon Business Hour.
It could be the last game of the year at Wrigley. We'll look at ticket prices for tonight's playoff game.
We'll talk with a veteran strategist who remembers the market crash 30 years ago today.
Technology Thursday, sponsored by Baird. How old is old enough for your child to have a smartphone?
Apple is facing sluggish sales of the iPhone 8, with the new iPhone 10 just weeks away.
On Wall Street right now, the Dow's down 29, the NASDAQ down 34, the S&P 500 down 3 points.
And it's 66 degrees right now, going to 71, with mostly sunny skies today.
WBBM News Time, 1231, as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues. Game 5 of the National League Championship Series tonight at Wrigley. Go Cubs, and the Cubs could be playing their last game of the year. Yep, we have to at least be honest and say that, even though we're hoping differently. Let's look at ticket prices with Sean Pate, vice president of the last-minute mobile ticketing app Game Time in San Francisco. Okay, Sean, what's it going to cost me to get into Wrigley tonight?
Well, Jim, you know, there's some renewed optimism, obviously, after last night. All it took was that flying one W and singing Go Cubs Go for Cubs fans ready to spend a little bit more money today. Looks like we're about $110 for a standing room ticket right now on Game Time. I did see a lot of prices come down yesterday, as we talked about. I think as the afternoon goes on, prices decline. There is a good amount of inventory. I've been watching the Game Time app this morning, and more tickets have come into the market over the last couple hours. So better selection and better pricing, which is going to be great.
And what about if, let's say, the Cubs win tonight, which, of course, they're going to. What about tickets in Chavez Ravine if anybody wants to head out there for games 6 and 7?
Yeah, it's a great option. And, you know, we've seen these types of comebacks before. It's not unprecedented. If you talk to a Red Sox fan, they'll tell you about that. But if you're thinking about using your frequent flyer miles and getting out to L.A., those tickets are running about the same price. It looks like $130 on the low end. And, again, the pressure would be back on the Dodgers if the Cubs were to win tonight.
All right. That's Sean Pate, Vice President of Game Time, a last-minute mobile ticketing app in San Francisco. And, Sean, I hope we're talking to you again because that means the Cubs are still going strong in the playoffs.
Well, let's switch from Wrigley Field to Wall Street, and we're looking at what's moving Wall Street. And we're also looking back 30 years in several of our segments today. Our guest, Art Hogan, Chief Market Strategist at Wunderlich Securities in New York City. Art, we're talking about the crash that occurred 30 years ago, what we've learned from it, and could it happen again?
Yeah, Chris, that's a great question, and I don't want to tell you exactly how old I am, but I was 26 when that happened back in October of 87. But fourth year into a job as a floor broker on the floor of the Boston Stock Exchange, and we really didn't know how bad things were going to get. We had a terrible week the week before. There's a member of the Ways and Means Committee that had floated a test balloon on some LBO M&A activity and taken away a preferential tax treatment. That really beat the market up the week before. So we were down better part of 10% the week before the crash in two record days in terms of both volume and point decline. So we certainly were beat up coming into the Monday. And I think most of us looking at it were hoping we get some sort of a bounce. And the exact opposite happened. Look at European markets overnight. Most markets were down 10% at least. And we knew things were going to get rough. And we knew after the first 90 minutes of trade, when we finally got most of the stocks open, it took a long time that no one was ever going to see a day like this in their lives before, and hopefully not again. It was just absolutely a plethora of doors and a lot of panic, and it just accelerated into the afternoon and continued to get worse.
Well, some of the things that they did to try to stop something like this, because of the when it's, the movement begins, it's all rolling, it gets bigger and bigger. Would those stand up?
Yeah, I think we haven't significantly tested some of the circuit breakers, but understand that the circuit breakers are set at 7% again, at 10% again, at 20%. So, and it depends on what time during the trading hour those things happen. So clearly, it's a function of when the market gets to that sell off point, and hopefully that's one of the things. And the other thing that we don't have is a mechanical what's called portfolio insurance that really added gasoline to the fire, because literally, you have portfolio managers that had significant gains over the last couple of years. The market was up about 100% over a 24-month period. And to hedge that, portfolio insurance really became something that became a self-fulfilling selling prophecy. So when the market went down, you sold more futures. The more futures you sold on the S&P 500, the more selling pressure there was in the market. So it became a vicious circle of selling, and it didn't really alleviate itself until midway through the Tuesday of the next day.
Are you nervous at all about the fact that the market is just as high as it is and it just keeps going higher?
Well, I would be if I thought it was driven by some sort of irrational exuberance, which I don't. I think it's been driven by synchronized global economic growth. This is the first time since 2007 where all of the developed countries in the world are in expansion. So that's good news, and that includes the United States. Earnings growth has been pretty good. Makes me a little nervous to be priced to perfection as we head into the earnings season right now. So if we have a bumpy road with some of the earnings, and we have about 200 companies reporting next week in the S&P 500, if we get a path of hurricane-related noise around some of those earnings results, that might be a reason to have one of the first retracements we've seen this year. The biggest retracement we've seen this year has been a 3% pullback in the S&P. So wouldn't be surprised if the earnings season, or perhaps a combination of the earnings season and maybe a disruptive decision in terms of who the next Fed chair is the cause for a 5% pullback, something we haven't seen in months.
Have the markets accounted for, Art, health care reform or the lack of it, and a tax reform or the lack of it as they factor the prices in? Or could those two things still cause some big swings in the markets?
Yeah, I think health care has effectively been back burner for the time being. Although we continue to talk about ways to hold up the current Obamacare system, the Affordable Care Act, and there'll be more noise around that. But I don't think anybody expects to get great news on healthcare. So that I think that's been effectively factored in. If you look at the healthcare stocks, drug companies, the hospital companies, worst performing sectors for obvious reasons this year with the uncertainty hanging out. And I think the other way to think about what's going on is that in tax reform or tax cuts, the real juxtaposition of that, what's going on there is we're part of the process, right? So the process has begun. The markets are looking at as, you know, baby steps. So the House passed their form of the budget. Now they're in the Ways and Means Committee putting together the details of a tax plan. The Senate probably passes their form of the budget today, and then it goes to the Senate Finance Committee, and they start working on their draft. So by Thanksgiving, we may well see the House's version of this tax bill. By Christmas, we may well see the Senate's version, and if they're close enough, then they'll get together in conference and hammer out a bill. My guess is tax reform or tax cuts are something we see in the first quarter of 2018, and it's going to be a battle, but I think it's going to be one that happens and has a better chance of happening than repeal and replace ever did.
Always nice to talk to you. Thanks, Art. Art Hogan is Chief Market Strategist at Wunderlich Securities in New York. And coming up, just when are our children old enough and mature enough to have their own iPhone? That's our Technology Thursday segment coming up.
News that makes you money. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday on the Noon Business Hour. We're talking about a common question among parents. When is the right time to allow your child to have a smartphone? And we're talking with Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for the news site Axios.com in San Francisco. Welcome back to the Noon Business Hour. I'm sure there's a lot of opinions on this, Ina. What do you suggest?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I mean, this is certainly one that I wrestle with. We have a 4.5-year-old, certainly doesn't have their own cell phone, but does get to use ours every now and then. I think there's a couple of guidelines. I mean, one is, in general, the pediatricians recommend don't give kids a lot of screen time or much of any before they're two. And then there's a huge period of time where they're certainly not ready for their own cell phone, but, you know, there's a lot of good educational content on there. And whether you get them like a cheap tablet, like a Kindle Fire, there's a lot of good Amazon content, or hand them your cell phone. I think there's a couple things to pay attention to. One is, what are they using? It's not just should they have a device or not, but also what are they using on the device?
Is there a discussion underway about how it affects the brain at a very early age?
There is. There's a bunch of research, into it. I think one of the things, you know, I tend to be, there's different camps for sure. I tend to be in the everything's good in moderation camp of things. And I think there's tons of really good educational content out there. I think it's making sure it doesn't come at the expense of other important things like being out and moving about, interacting with friends. So I think it's a question of how much time, not all or nothing. And then the giving a kid a cell phone is a little bit different of a question because you want to make sure they're responsible enough not to ring up a bunch of charges. Their benefits, certainly as a parent, you can keep in better contact. In general, if kids aren't away from you much, there's not a lot of reason for them to have a cell phone. But as soon as they're out of you're sort of out of touch with them, you know, it's a benefit to parents, too. So you have to weigh that as well.
Ina, isn't this a good opportunity, too, to teach kids about, you know, comparison shopping and, okay, maybe an iPhone is expensive. Maybe this particular model of phone that's not so expensive will work for you. Maybe it's a good economics lesson.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's all kinds of good lessons to be taught here. Certainly, it's something they have to be responsible for. If I was giving a kid an expensive phone, I'd probably want to have insurance in case it gets lost or stolen or broken. But it is good to teach those things. Again, I think there's all kinds of lessons. And again, don't underestimate the educational benefit of some of the content out there, but it's not universally good. You know, there's a big difference between some of the best educational content out of there and some games that are reinforcing stereotypes that maybe you don't want to pass on to your kids.
Ina Fried, who is the Chief Technology Correspondent for the news site Axios.com out of San Francisco. Thanks, as always, for joining us on Technology Thursday, sponsored by Baird. And join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, trouble in the apple tree, sluggish sales of the new iPhone 8.
Loaning useful information each weekday. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Shares of Apple are off 2.5% as the tech giant scrambles for a solution to sluggish sales of its new iPhone 8. And we are joined by Angelo Zeno, a senior equity analyst at CFRA Research in New York City. Welcome back to the program, Angelo. What's the problem with Apple?
Yeah, so when we look at the iPhone 8 here, we really attribute to the softness to really three different items. First is, of course, we think consumers are holding off for that iPhone 10. That's the most hyped up phone that we've now kind of come across in about 3 years, since, of course, the iPhone 6. Second, I'd say is, we're just not seeing the type of promotions that we've seen from wireless carriers in recent years. And then finally, of course, is when we look at the iPhone 7, the cost of that obviously went down $100 as we've always seen from prior cycles. But the difference here is the iPhone 8 price actually went up $50. So we're talking about $150 differential. And I think consumers, for the most part, are willing to kind of forego buying that iPhone 8 for the iPhone 7.
My first impression was, well, maybe they're waiting for the 10. So if there is a big response to the 10, then Apple's in pretty good shape.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope so. I mean, when we look at the 10, we're talking about a phone that's priced at about $1,000 relative to, predecessor phones, which were between $650 and $750. Now it's, $700, $800. So, we absolutely think that, we remain bullish on the whole story here and do think that, consumers are going to gravitate to this higher-priced phone that's going to have new features like the crystal clear OLED screens, among other things. I think the bigger concern is going to be what are the supply constraints going to look like with this phone?
Because there's a concern that iPhone 10 sales won't be able to make up for a slump in 8 sales because there won't be enough iPhone 10s, correct?
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know what? I mean, we're talking about Apple's most important quarter here being that December quarter ahead of that holiday season. So it's going to be extremely critical to see how quickly they ramp up on this iPhone 10 device, and whether consumers are willing to hold on to buying an iPhone 10 device post the holiday season, should there not be enough in time for that all important year-end period.
Angelo, what's your recommendation on Apple?
Yeah, so we continue to have a buy recommendation on the shares. Our 12-month target price is $175, and we continue to see a great story for Apple outside of only the iPhone. Also related to that services business, among other things.
All right, Angelo Zeno, the senior equity analyst at CFRA Research in New York. As always, a pleasure to have you on. And you'll find past programs and later today a podcast of this hour at cbschicago.com/audio and on the all-new radio.com app. WBBM News Time, 12:55. Time for a look at the market, sponsored by Lake Forest Sports Cars, the Ferrari specialists. Here's Joan Doniger.
Jim, Wall Street is not marking the 30th anniversary of the 1987 crash with losses. Today, it's only stepping back from records with the help of Apple. The Dow is down 26, the NASDAQ 34, the S&P 3. Now, Apple trades on all three averages. It's down about 3% on those indications of weak sales of the iPhone 8. The Bloomberg WBBM Chicago Index is falling 0.5% now, dragged thanks to the almost 11% drop in shares of United Continental. Investors seeing some turbulence ahead in the company's earnings report. This summer's fair war cut ticket prices. That's dragging on profit expectations for the current quarter. Ulta shares, however, are rising about 4% after Twitter speculation on a beauty company buyout with at least one mention of Amazon as a potential buyer. With business at 25 and 55, live from the Bloomberg Newsroom, Joan Doniger, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
WBBM and HD Chicago, WCFS FM and HD1 Elmwood Park, Chicago.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.